You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So even if we are still at the very beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, we can still ask very thoughtful questions of ourselves of what lessons we can learn from the history. History teaches us, right, of Spanish flu a century ago. We're spending the hour drawing comparisons and contrasts on how the Spanish flu changed the world and how it didn't. Do you remember old family stories about how the flu pandemic of 1918 affected the world? Do you know how it affected your ancestors? What connections can you draw with what the world is going through today? Let's talk about it this hour, 800-642-1234. Laura Spinney is a science journalist based in Paris. Her most recent nonfiction book is on the Spanish flu of 1918. It's called Pale Rider. It came out in 2018 here in the U.S. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So take us back to 1918. The first wave of the pandemic was generally mild. The sick who experienced flu symptoms like chills and fever, they usually recovered in a few days. How did that change?
So the 1918 pandemic struck in three waves. And the first one, you're absolutely right, was relatively mild, not that different from seasonal flu. And it receded, depending on where you were in the world, towards the late spring, early summer. In the Northern Hemisphere. And then it came back with a vengeance in the latter part of August. And that was the second wave, which was by far the most deadly. The vast majority of the 50 million estimated deaths in that pandemic took place in 13 weeks between the middle of September and the middle of December 1918. That second wave then receded towards the end of the year. And there was a third wave. Again, timing depends on where you were in the world. But in the early months of 1919 for the Northern Hemisphere, which was intermediate in severity between the other two.
There must have been a lot of confusion and so much fear about what exactly was happening and if it would come back again.
I think there was huge fear, yeah, and also confusion, you're absolutely right, not just amongst ordinary people, but also amongst doctors and scientists, because it was really difficult to know what they were dealing with. In that lethal second wave, and also in some severe cases in the first wave, people were dying of something that looked not at all like flu. It was very, very, a very severe form of flu. So people, you know, they started off with the usual symptoms, sore throat, fever, aches and pains, headache. And then in those cases that were, you know, that became severe, because even then the vast majority of people recovered. But let's say a much larger minority went on to develop severe cases. And in those cases, their faces turned blue, they had trouble breathing, they even bled from their noses and mouths.
Lungs filling up with fluid.
Exactly, the massive inflammatory reaction in the lungs that actually we're seeing in severe COVID cases today. It's called a cytokine storm. And then, you know, horribly, the body would turn from blue to black. And at that point, there was really little hope of recovery and the person would die within hours or days. So much confusion. It didn't look like flu. They didn't have a reliable diagnostic test. And it got called things like cholera, typhoid, even plague, pneumonic plague.
We're talking with science journalist Laura Spinney. She wrote a book on the Spanish flu of 1918. You can join in. What questions can you draw with what the world is going through today? And is it an accurate comparison? What do you want to ask her about what happened a century ago? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, I anticipate you get asked this a lot, but what comparisons are you seeing? What looks similar to you about the pandemic we're faced today?
So I am asked this question a lot. And I think it's really important to say at the beginning that the 1918 pandemic was very, very exceptional in many, many ways. I mean, it was huge. It killed 50 million people minimum. Some people say twice as many as that. The equivalent number today would be somewhere between 220 and 440 million people. So it was really, you know, it was really an anomaly in the annals of pandemics and in modern history. We, by the way, we've had 15 flu pandemics scientists estimate in the last 500 years. And none of them that we know of or that have been roughly measured killed anywhere near like that. So, I mean, there's lots of legitimate questions to ask about why it was so bad in 1918 and lots of fascinating theories to do with the world being at war, for example. But in sheer terms of numbers, I think more appropriate comparisons would be, for example, with the two other flu pandemics of the 20th century, the so-called Asian flu of 1957 or the Hong Kong flu of 1968. The first of those killed no more than 2 million, the second no more than 4 million, which obviously is an awful lot of deaths, but it's nowhere near the Spanish flu. That was in a ballpark of its own. And though I desperately hope that we don't even see that many deaths in this current pandemic, they seem, you know, more appropriate comparisons.
Why are they more appropriate comparisons than what we're seeing today?
To what we're seeing today, just because I think that in large parts of the world, we're seeing the first wave of this pandemic draw to a close. Mm-hmm. Now, there may be a second wave. There may be subsequent waves. We don't yet know if the second wave will be better or worse, smaller or bigger than the first wave. And a lot of it, in fact, most of it will depend on how we ourselves behave, on human behavior. But the likelihood is, I'd say, relatively optimistic in the sense that we've already learned an awful lot about this virus. And, I think that in the long term, we're going to get better at suppressing it. So I think the most likely scenario, and I'm not an expert, I'm not a medic or a scientist, but I think the most likely scenario is that the waves get smaller each time. We'll probably have to live with this virus forever, I think, rather like the viruses that cause the common cold, which are related to this one. But I think this one will probably become more benign over time and will also get better at reining it in. That means all sorts of things. It's very difficult to say, for example, right now, how many will die in this pandemic by the end of it, because we're just not at the end of it yet.
Why was the estimated death toll of the Spanish flu so wildly different? 50 to 100 million, yeah. That's a wide range.
That's a huge range. And the essential problem was counting the dead. And that doesn't sound that unfamiliar, does it? We're kind of having that problem again today, to our amazement. It's actually quite difficult, especially in winter season when there are many other respiratory diseases around. If you've got a shortage of testing, you don't necessarily know what people are suffering from when they die. It's a huge task to count them all. And it wasn't even possible in 1918. They had no reliable diagnostic test. And the reason for that was very simple. They knew hardly anything about viruses. The first viruses had been identified at the end of the 19th century. Flu, of course, is caused by a virus like COVID. So almost every doctor in the world in 1918 thought they were dealing with a bacterial disease. And that kind of set them off on the wrong path, if you like, in many different ways. It's the reason why it goes under different names in the historical archives. It's the reason why they desperately tried to make vaccines against bacteria they found in people's throats. And of course, those vaccines were, for the most part, ineffective. And it just confused everything on every level. But it's also the main reason we don't know with any accuracy how many people died then.
We have science journalist Laura Spinney taking us through the Spanish flu a century ago and what lessons carry over today in more recent pandemics. What were you taught in school about how the flu pandemic changed society? What lessons do you expect the world to learn from the coronavirus pandemic? Be part of this discussion. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Laura Spinney here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the lessons from the Spanish flu pandemic a century ago. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The fact that it became known as Spanish flu is particularly unfair to the Spanish because it's not where it originated. We're talking with science journalist Laura Spinney. What questions do you want to know about the fears, about the xenophobia, about what emerged from this pandemic? Do you think we've learned valuable lessons from earlier pandemics, or Our society's too soon to forget. There's room to talk, 800-642-1234. Laura Spinney is the author of the book Pale Rider about the Spanish flu, and she stays with us. So, Laura, what about the name Spanish flu? It apparently is not where it came from in Spain, but how did Spain get this moniker?
Unfairly. So, yeah, there are many questions that remain unanswered about the 1918 pandemic. One of the few things we're certain about is that it did not start in Spain. And the reason we know that is because we know there were cases in America, in Britain, where I come from, in France, where I live, and in a number of other countries before there were cases in Spain. But those countries were at war, and so they were censoring their press, and they stopped information about cases of flu in their own countries getting into their newspapers because they were afraid it would lower the morale of the population. Spain, on the other hand, was neutral in the war, and so it didn't censor its press. And when the first cases happened in Madrid in, I think it was May of 1918, they were reported on. And they included the King of Spain, Alfonso XIII, who went on to recover. But his case made it very visible, if you like. So it seemed not only to the Spanish themselves, but to people in other countries who were unaware that the flu was there also, unless they themselves were ill, of course. It seemed to everybody reading their newspapers that this disease was rippling out from Madrid. And so it was called the Spanish flu. The governments of those other countries encouraged that nickname because it suited them to point the finger of blame elsewhere. And it stuck.
We have a call from Vern in Boyd, called in to ask, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to find out that World War I, Vern thinks, probably contributed to the spread of the virus and is curious to know about how the Great War affected this pandemic.
It's a really good question because, you know, I was saying earlier that we have to explain why this pandemic was so particularly deadly, much more deadly than any other flu pandemic we know about. And there are scientific reasons to think that the virus itself was pretty exceptional in some ways, that it was inherently a very vicious virus. But there are also theories, and these are not mutually exclusive, it could be lots of different factors. There are also theories that it's because the world was at war, you know, that the world was in a particularly exceptional set of conditions and circumstances. One idea, for example, is that so many people were on the move, not just troops, but also refugees, displaced civilians, and many of them were very hungry. Their health was compromised in other ways. They were frightened and stressed, all of which makes you more vulnerable to the flu, and they spread it around the world. But there's another theory which has to do with when the flu got into the trenches of Flanders, of northern France and Belgium. Normally, a flu virus moderates its virulence over time because it's sort of in its interest to keep its hosts alive since it travels from host to host. If it wants to survive, it needs to keep its host alive in evolutionary terms. So the idea is that these young men in the trenches were packed so tightly together, you know, if they managed to survive, they weren't going anywhere. So they weren't transmitting the virus as people normally would. And in those conditions, there was no pressure on the virus to moderate its virulence. So it remained virulent for longer. And that's one of the theories why it may have killed so many people so quickly.
We're talking with Laura Spinney, wrote a nonfiction book about the Spanish flu, How It Changed the World. Pale Rider is the name of it. Taking your questions about what it was like a century ago and how that compares to previous pandemics and today, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Saul now in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hello. I just had a question, not exactly on topic, but that is, is there a history of any successful vaccines against a coronavirus in animals or in humans?
Not that has been approved. Some viruses were developed, vaccines were developed to SARS, which was the epidemic of a related disease that broke out in Asia, in China in 2002-03. And also to MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which broke out in the Middle East in 2000. itself. The scientists began to develop vaccines to both of those, but the problem was that both epidemics were contained, suppressed, before the vaccines were ready. So they were kind of shelved. But what's really interesting is that they've been kind of dusted off and they're being repurposed now for COVID. It's all very experimental. And as I'm sure you've heard, we probably won't have any kind of vaccine for 12 months at the earliest. But those adapted vaccines for other coronaviruses are among the candidates that are being tested now.
Would those potential vaccines that have been shelved from, past traumas, could that give us a head start, a leg up to figuring out a vaccine that would work this time around?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. A lot of the work has been done, but the really crucial part of developing a vaccine, the kind of laborious and time-consuming part, are the clinical trials when they're tested in humans, and especially the later phase clinical trials when you have to do it in a lot of people, when you've already shown that they're safe and now you need to show that they're effective, that they actually protect people against disease. That takes time because you really want to be absolutely sure that you've got no adverse effects, no, late developing side effects that would make the vaccine unusable in a large population. So it's very difficult. You can take some shortcuts in the development of a vaccine without compromising safety and efficacy, and people are just talking about that at the moment with a view to getting a vaccine out as quickly as possible. But there are some things you just cannot cut short, and the safety and efficacy testing in humans is part of that.
Saul, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Michael now in Mequon with a question. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, good morning. First, I wanted to say thank you for your book. I read it when it came out. I thought it was an excellent book.
Thank you very much.
With regard to, I just want to make a comment about the comparison of the Asian and the swine flu versus the Spanish flu. Back when the Spanish flu hit, we didn't have oxygen as a routine treatment, so that may have been one of the reasons that plus antibiotics may have had an impact on why the death rates were much lower. But my questions were, since Wilson didn't talk publicly about the Spanish flu in the U.S., what was the response of other government leaders in other countries? And my second question is, how did this flu act as a catalyst to change healthcare in terms of improving education, protocols, hospital care, et cetera, government policies, things like that?
Great questions, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So what did the leaders do? Well, not much to begin with, because the world was at war and they, in most cases, considered the war to be their priority. That was definitely the case of Woodrow Wilson, but not only. And so you see these kind of unhelpful from a public health point of view, moves like censoring information and basically just, for example, President Wilson ordered that the transports that carried troops across the Atlantic would not stop, despite the advice from his senior military medics. He insisted they continue, and so they basically ploughed, flew back and forth across the Atlantic, and the scenes on those ships were just horrific. And the same in Europe. There was a kind of a sense of this is our secondary problem, and we're going to ignore it and just continue to pursue the war. That was the attitude. Of course, the war ended in November of 1918, which was round about the peak of that deadly second wave. By then, they'd realized they really had a problem on their hands, and they were taking it more seriously. And you saw public health measures being put in place in many countries, pretty much a little bit earlier from the beginning of that autumn wave, because it was so deadly and so devastating. But it wasn't really anything like lockdown in the sense that we see it today. In fact, this lockdown that we're seeing today is really an unprecedented experiment in the history of humanity. It wouldn't have been possible then, not only because the resources and the infrastructure were not in place, even the surveillance, there was no surveillance, disease surveillance, but also because people were much less used to having the authorities intervene in their lives for public health reasons. It was a foreign idea to lots of people in the world at that time, not in your country. Your country was pretty advanced in that sense. But for many people, it was very foreign to be told what to do for your health. And so, you see a kind of very patchy, very delayed response. Often when measures were put in place, they were lifted too soon. And many historians will say to you that when you look at the 1918 pandemic, you're essentially looking at a pandemic that ran its natural course.
Talking with science journalist Laura Spinney, she's our guide to Spanish flu, how we can bring this historical lens to the current crisis, current situation. What lessons do you expect the world to learn from the coronavirus pandemic? Join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We'll talk more with Laura Spinney right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're going back a century to the Spanish flu pandemic. Estimates are that between 50 and 100 people died worldwide in the three flu waves of 1918 to 1919. And after the Spanish flu, we see the founding of the Health Organization of the League of Nations. That was the forerunner of the WHO, the World Health Organization. And this notion that the global community can only overcome a crisis working together. So still time to draw contrasts, comparisons, your questions, 800-642-1234. We have science journalist Laura Spinney with us for the hour. She wrote a book about how the Spanish flu changed the world. And Laura, let's get to the second part of Michael's question, who called in from Mequon this morning. Was the Spanish flu a catalyst for changing healthcare in any way?
Yes, I think it was. I certainly argue that in my book. It's like a lot of things. There had been discussion, particularly in Europe prior to the pandemic, about instituting socialized models of healthcare, that is, healthcare that's free at the point of delivery. But nothing had really happened about it. And the pandemic, I think, acted as a catalyst because there was an understanding, a new understanding born of that pandemic, that a pandemic is a global, is a population level problem, and you need to treat the population. There's no point in just treating those people who can afford it and so on, or the elites or certain subgroups. You won't rein it in. So you see, for example, in Europe, the move towards reorganizing healthcare, which began with the very important question of how to pay for it. And as I say, these conversations had happened beforehand, but you see all this really being implemented from the 1920s on. National Health Service in my country, the UK, didn't come into being until 1947, but that's because it takes time to put such systems into place. And also because there was plenty of political resistance to it, like there is today. The US also had a realization, I think, that you needed to widen your net. You needed to make healthcare available to more people. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to prevent epidemics. But they go in a different direction in terms of how to pay for it, as you know. They go towards employer-based insurance schemes, whereas in Europe, our schemes were more about taxation and national insurance. And in fact, Russia, under Lenin, was the first country to put in place a socialized healthcare system. It wasn't universal to begin with because it only looked after people in the cities. It eventually got extended to rural areas as well, not until the 60s, because, as I say, it takes time to do these things. But Lenin, interestingly, was motivated by having seen that epidemics that came in the wake of the First World War and the Russian revolutions and the Russian Civil War had very nearly wiped out the working class that he was pinning his hopes on to, you know, launch a new society in Russia. So that's one aspect. And I think the other aspect is that, you know, it, as you mentioned, it gave rise to the concept of, you know, of the need of a global health agency that coordinates the response globally. The WHO, which we have today, wasn't until after the Second World War. Its forerunners, started coming into being from the 1920s.
Did the idea of acting with a single voice on world health, did the WHO formation make a difference in latter pandemics?
Very much so, yeah. And, most recently, I think you can see how it coordinated a response in the most recent Ebola outbreak in Africa. I mean, it was criticized in 2014 for moving too slowly. And, you know, we can talk about the imperfections of the WHO if you like. I'm not saying it's perfect. And in fact, it's in the process of being reformed now. But I don't think even its most fiercest critics would ever, you know, in the public health community, would ever question the idea that we need a global agency to coordinate responses. And we're seeing it again now. In fact, this is a critical moment in the COVID pandemic, because countries are beginning to lift their lockdowns. If we don't do that in a coordinated way, according to a single playbook where, you know, you lift measures according to how much you've suppressed the epidemic in your own country, if all the countries aren't playing by the same rules, then it won't work, because, you know, we are not, borders don't keep viruses out. So no country is an island, and we can easily infect each other. So I think it's really important that there's one agency telling us what, you know, what milestones to look for, and that we all appreciate, you know, to stick by those milestones as we come out of lockdown.
Looking at the workers during the Spanish flu, particularly lethal for people aged 20 to 40, do we know why this age range struggled so much with the Spanish flu?
I mean, it's a great question, because it is a mystery for so long. I mean, flu, as we know, generally hits the very young and the very old. And here was the 1918 flu, which was most devastating in the middle age group of those adults, aged 20 to 40, slightly more men than women, by the way, globally. But it's mainly for that reason that it was so devastating, because we're talking about a time when there was little, if any, social welfare net in any country, no organized adoption for children. And you're talking about taking out of communities the most productive adults in the prime of life, the workers, the ones who are, you know, bringing the bread home and who are the pillars of communities, parents. So they left behind, in many cases, dependents, elderly and small children, and those people had no visible means of support. So from the little information there is about what happened to them, we know that a lot of the elderly went into workhouses. A lot of the children were taken in by their extended families or became wards of state, if they were lucky, if they didn't go into the street or into service. So I think that's one of the reasons why it was so devastating. Why it hit that middle group is really interesting. I don't think we have all the answers, but one leading theory is that it has to do with the idea that your immune system is most well adapted to the first flu strain it ever sees in life. So the first flu you're infected with as a child. Hmm. And for people who were in that age group, it was probably the flu they encountered in the previous pandemic, the so-called Russian flu of the 1890s, when they were very little, which was a completely different type of influenza. It was H3N8, probably, which is very different from H1N1 that caused 1918. So in other words, the idea is that their immune systems were not at all primed for this new flu, and therefore they had a sort of maladaptive immune reaction to it. And that's why they were so vulnerable.
We're talking with science journalist Laura Spinney, our guide to the 1918 flu pandemic, with your questions along the way. Laura, we heard from Matt in Johnson Creek, specifically in the area of meat processing plants, which have emerged as hotspots for the spread of the coronavirus because workers, they're working side by side in close quarters. Do you have any history there on meat processing plants and infectious disease?
Okay, so long before, and I don't know the details of those outbreaks, but I do know that this COVID was a problem in the world long before it reached those meat processing plants. Okay, so it doesn't have anything to do with that meat processing. If there are problems in meat processing plants, it is probably to do with the way that people work there, with the need to separate social distancing while doing that job, which may be particularly difficult to implement. You know, this is a disease which tends to break out in clusters. We've seen that from the very beginning in Wuhan in China, then in Italy. It's a disease that forms clusters, unlike flu. It's one of the big differences between the two. There's also kind of, in a sense, an element of luck, or rather bad luck. You know, once it gets into a place, then you may have an outbreak, but it could have been, you know, an accidental introduction in the first place. So I don't think there's anything to be said about those particular clusters that connects this disease with meat processing in any fundamental way. Having said that, globally, the causes, the long-term causes of the emergence of new diseases of animal origin, we call them zoonoses, you know, infections that jump the species barrier into us.
Spillover.
Exactly, spillover, is linked to kind of globalized industries, which are, you know, which by which we humans are pushing into new ecosystems, you know, coming into contact with new pathogens. And that is partly to do with, I mean, it's all kinds of industries. It's logging and mining in Africa. It's the illicit wildlife trade, but it's also factory farming. Because factory farming, in order to feed the many, you know, the nearly 8 billion of us there are now on the planet, an unprecedented number, has to take up more and more space. And so not only is it taking up more space itself, but it's pushing out other activities into the margins, closer to those areas where the pathogens lurk. And so it's a kind of globally complex, you know, dynamic system. But we are, in our own indirect way, and factory farming is definitely a part of it, are contributing to spillover.
Let's bring in Russ now in Stoughton with a question. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. In regards to deaths attributed to the Spanish flu across the country, I'm recalling a book written by, and I'm glad that your producer reminded me, by Upton Sinclair, and was called The Jungle. And it basically discussed the lack of sanitation for people living in tenements all around the Chicago stockyards. But it, there was a lack of, you know, sanitation sewers. And I guess people dumped whatever human waste and whatever else they had, maybe down the central drain. And I think that that was the cause, according to his book, for many, many deaths, and the germs just flowed because people could not get away from them.
Russ, let's pause there for Laura to respond, because we are short on time here. Go ahead, Laura.
I mean, so you're absolutely right that bad living conditions, crowded living conditions above all, you know, where people were squashed together in tenements, and maybe the ventilation wasn't very good, and maybe they weren't well fed, and they worked very long hours, and they didn't have good access to healthcare. All of those things contributed to their vulnerability to the Spanish flu. But the Spanish flu, it probably didn't come from those insanitary conditions. It probably started, you know, more to do with the mechanism that I was talking about earlier. But the fact that people lived in those conditions definitely made them more vulnerable to it, for sure. And you can see the effect globally. It was definitely the poorer, the working classes, people living in developing poor countries that bore the burden of that pandemic.
We're talking with science journalist Laura Spinney about lessons drawn from the Spanish flu, what a post-coronavirus world might look like. You can join in, still time to talk, at 800-642-1234. Do you remember old family stories about the flu pandemic of 1918? What questions do you have about it? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute with Laura Spinney here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're spending the hour on lessons learned from the 1918 flu, how our world responds to pandemics. We're reflecting on how societies learn to move forward after them, and how the Spanish flu altered global politics and family structures, thinking straight across medicine, race relations, religion, the arts. Still time for your questions about this history. 800-642-1234. Laura Spinney is the author of several books, and her latest nonfiction one is about the Spanish flu pandemic. Let's take another call now. Steve is joining us from Wausau. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Sure.
I just wanted to know if it was true that the people, in order to fight the infections, would hang their sheets up on the roof, trying to get the sun on the sunny side of the house to disinfect their sheets and things like that. And, of course, the other people in the neighborhood knew that you had this pandemic at that time. I guess they were quite doing that rather than just hanging them on the clothesline.
Ah, disinfecting linens and that being a communication tool. Laura, is there anything to that?
I hadn't heard that one with the sunshine. I had heard about humid sheets being hung up around a person's bed. I don't think there's any evidence that any of these things worked. But you have to remember that it was a time when the doctors were at a loss to know how to treat this disease. You know, they had no vaccine. As I said, they had no reliable test to start with. There were no antiviral drugs. Those weren't invented until the 60s. And there were no antibiotics, which, although, of course, they don't work on a virus, may have made a difference on the bacterial complications that caused pneumonia in many of the patients who went on to die. So they could have been useful in the latter stages of the disease. But they had none of that. And so many people were thrown back on folk remedies, herbal remedies, what now we will call alternative medicine, even very ancient practices like bloodletting. They tried everything because they were desperate and they were frightened.
Steve, thanks. Let's bring in Rich now in Appleton. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I want to thank you for this conversation this morning. I haven't read Laura Spinney's book, but I do want to relate a family story. My grandfather on my father's side died in the 1918 pandemic, but he didn't die in the original outbreak. He died in the summer of 2019. And the only reason that I know this is because he was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And it's basically through family stories. But then I went and got his death certificate, basically. And I know the story from the community that I grew up in and the stories of how difficult it was to handle the pandemic when it came back on rebound, basically in 1919.
Yeah.
Yeah. But my father was born in February and he died in the summer. So my father was raised by a stepfather, and that's basically my family story.
Wow. Rich, thank you for bringing that. Laura, what is so valuable about these family stories passed forward?
I mean, it's fascinating. Thanks so much, Rich, for sharing that story. You know, when I was working on my book, I would come across, you know, most of the people I met, who, if I mentioned it to them, they would recall some relation who had either died of the Spanish flu or recovered from it. And I realized that there was memory for this event, but it was kind of tucked into people's brains of their own family histories. It wasn't, you know, we don't remember it collectively as something that happened to humanity. If you ask people what were the major catastrophes of the 20th century, very few people mention the Spanish flu. So it's really curious the way that we remember this terrible disaster. And I think Richard's story sort of speaks to that. He's absolutely right. The dates, as I mentioned, of the waves kind of varied depending on where you were in the world. And also, it didn't just disappear one day. It kind of receded gradually in each place. And so perhaps Rich's grandfather was, an unlucky victim of the tail end of that last wave. But we know, for example, that there were cases still raging in the Pacific Islands as late as 1921. So, it takes a long time to vanish completely.
Well, when you talk about the absence of a collective knowledge on the Spanish flu and talking about it collectively, what do you see out of survivor's guilt and how families responded?
So if you think about this, you know, very vulnerable group of the 20 to 40 year olds, it really tore a hole out of families and out of communities. And I think, you know, the way I put it in my book is that afterwards you see this kind of musical chairs where society reshuffles and people remarry and some people fall through the cracks. The widows or children who can't find, you know, a place in a family or can't find a new husband, they just kind of fall through the cracks because, as I say, it's a time when there was no social welfare. So, it had a huge effect on humanity, shaking it up. And, you know, humanity rebounds. That's what we do as a species. We adapt. You see this huge baby boom in the 1920s, which partly can be put down to the war and the men coming back from the front, but partly can also be put down to the flu. The fact that some of the weakest people in society, those suffering from TB, for example, had been purged had been the first to be carried off by the flu, leaving behind a smaller and a healthier population that was able to reproduce at a higher rate. That's evolution. That's the way that we adapt and we advance. Unfortunately, it comes at the price of huge human suffering. If you zoom in to look at the individual level, you know, that reshuffle did not happen without a huge amount of suffering and pain.
Do we learn after pandemics? Do we, as a society, take what happened going forward and fix and understand what we need to do differently? Or do we forget?
Both. So we do advance. I mean, if you think about us 100 years on, we've got all those things I said they didn't have in 1918. We've got vaccines, we've got antibiotics, we've got antivirals, and we have a very much more effective disease surveillance mechanism. We have tests. But I think if you asked a room full of public health experts, they'd probably say their consensus would probably be that we don't learn fast enough. And we do have this sort of shorter term tendency to forget as soon as it's over, become kind of complacent, forget to do all the things the WHO and others are telling us to do outside pandemics to make us more, protect ourselves against the next one, because there will be a next one. We forget to do those things, and then we panic when the next one comes along, as if we weren't warned, but we were warned. There will be another pandemic after this one. It could be worse. That's a possibility. And so we should be doing those things like, for example, collectively investing in the health infrastructure in the poorest countries in the world, because in the pandemic, as now, we're only as safe as our least safe place. We should be, regulating the interface between animals and humans better, you know, where the spillovers occur. We should be doing lots of things that would make us better prepared next time. And let's hope we do them this time.
Laura, how are you getting along in Paris?
It's okay. I mean, we have quite a strict confinement here. So the city is very quiet, very empty. I'm not allowed out except for an hour a day. I have to fill out a form. I can't go further than 1 kilometer from my house. You know, it's beginning to drag. I think, like for everyone, it's boring. But I have a unique situation in that I'm quite busy talking about it, writing about it. So in that way, I feel very lucky. But it's fascinating. It's shocking. I find it frightening like everybody else, but I also find it really fascinating to be inside one rather than to be writing about it retrospectively as I was a couple of years ago.
What are you writing these days?
Mainly journalism about this pandemic.
Sure.
I'm doing a lot of reporting on it. But I think maybe I need an antidote once this is all over, and I might go back and write some more fiction just to soothe my soul.
Just to go into another world where facts can matter or not.
Sorry for the happy ending.
Oh, dear. Well, Laura, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
For the invitation.
Laura Spinney is a science journalist. She is based in Paris, and her book is called Pale Rider. Coming up, it is On Point. Stay with us for On Point. The coronavirus pandemic has fundamentally altered the economy for the foreseeable future. So what do we need to do to make it work again? We'll explore that question. On Point is next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.